Our podcast reviews well-known movies and contains spoilers. The podcast may contain mature subject matter and mature language. Listener discretion is advised. Enjoy the show.
Quiet on set. Places, everybody. And action.
It's time once again for the Hooked on Movies podcast. Today's movie is a supernatural comedy from 1984, directed by Ivan Reitman. And of course, we are talking about Ghostbusters.
Who's going to call?
Who are you going to call? That's right. With me, our Ted.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass.
And Ken.
Human sacrifices, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
And I'm Eric. Ray, when someone asks you if you're a god, you say yes. Some memorable lines there from Ghostbusters. The original Ghostbusters from 1984, not the sad remakes and posy-like ones that they're trying to crush down your throat. But the new one that's coming out, Frozen Empire, that one is still an open book as to how it will be. Maybe we'll review it down the road. Ken, give us the synopsis of Ghostbusters.
After the members of a team of scientists lose their cushy positions at a university in New York City, they decide to become Ghostbusters to wage a high-tech battle with the supernatural for money. They stumble upon a gateway to another dimension, a doorway that will release evil upon the city. The Ghostbusters must now save New York from complete destruction. That is the synopsis for Ghostbusters.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good indeed. Ted, what are the particulars of this one?
Okay, Ghostbusters, directed by Ivan Reitman, with a screenplay by Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis. It has a running time of 105 minutes, a release date of June 8th, 1984. It has a budget of $30 million. It had a box office gross of $295.2 million. And on Rotten Tomatoes, the critic score is a certified fresh 95% and an audience score of 88%. On IMDb, it has a user rating of 7.8. Ghostbusters stars Bill Murray as Peter Venkman, Dan Aykroyd as Ray Stantz, Harold Ramis as Egon Spengler, Ernie Hudson as Winston Zeddemore, Sigourney Weaver as Dana Barrett, Rick Moranis as Louis Tully, Annie Potts as Jane Malintz, and William Atherton as Walter Peck.
And so many little cameos there.
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
Not as many as the music video.
That's true. Yes, homie. Not as many. Yes, I mean, George Wendt, Dana Plato, so many in
John
Ray Dana. Parker's. Anyone who was
Dana
like,
Plato, you out of all those, you went with Dana Plato, huh?
Dude,
she was 1984.
84,
hey, might
man,
as well go
come
with
on.
Melissa Gilbert at Little House in the Prairie, right?
So. I mean, 84, man, she was top of the charts with Different Strokes. Everyone in that cast, come on. George Wendt with Cheers. Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of cameos in that one. That was such. Great. Yeah, Terry Garr. Such a great movie, music video.
Oh,
my. We could do a whole podcast just on that music video, but we will not because we are going to talk about productions and awards, Ken, and this one's got a few of them.
Well, Ghostbusters was inspired by Dan Aykroyd's fascination with the belief of the paranormal. I mean, Dan Aykroyd is a little crazy when it comes to that. I think Ted was talking about this offline about Dan Aykroyd thinks he's been abducted. Probably been an anal probe too. He inherited all this from his father. His father actually wrote a book called A History of Ghosts. His mother had seen ghosts. His grandfather had experimented with radios to contact the dead. And his great grandfather was a renowned spiritualist. So just passed down to generation to generation.
We all know spiritualism is a bunch of shit, right?
Ted. I'm not going to debate you. That. No, I'm not going to debate you on this. I'm kind of on Aykroyd when it comes to some of this stuff.
I like parapsychology. Don't get me wrong. And I believe in ghosts.
Yes.
I don't believe in spiritualists.
Are you afraid of ghosts?
No.
I ain't afraid of no ghosts.
But I'm just saying the spiritualist, like, of the time of, we're talking about Aykroyd's, was it his great-grandfather?
Oh, like hacks. Yeah, they were I'm all talking about,
like,
con
the
men.
Era. Yeah, like the era con of men. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's time, where he was feuding with Houdini. That's what I'm talking about.
Let's get a Ouija board out and let's see what we can do with it.
We're going to stick with ghosts. 1984 ghosts. Continue, Ken.
Aykroyd's original idea was set in the future, but he brought on Ivan Reitman as the director and producer, and Reitman was like, no. And
it was the studio who said no effing way.
I think it was also Reitman. I think Reitman was like, uh-uh. Because Aykroyd has a tendency to kind of go off the deep end when it comes to his writing. He's gifted in a lot of ways. Writing's one of them, but he just kind of goes a little overboard. And so he brought in Reitman and Ramis. The all three of them went to Aykroyd's, I think. What's that famous vineyard?
Martha's Vineyard?
Martha's Vineyard, yeah. And they all just kind of worked on the script there.
Did a shitload of drugs and a lot of booze and put this bad boy together.
I don't know if they did a lot of that because they brought their families along with. Rumor has it that Aykroyd like stuffed their refrigerators with food and stuff. I guess he's like a great host. He really goes all out for them. So another fun fact, and I remember doing this. Back in the day, they had that phone number in the movie. For Ghostbusters, instead of 555, they replaced it with a 1-800 number, and you can call, and you can hear Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd saying that they're off chasing ghosts. It kind of kept the things going. I guess they got a lot of calls. And then as far as the roles for this movie, originally Dan Aykroyd had John Belushi in mind. But of course, Belushi had passed away, so that's how they got Bill Murray, who until the start of the movie and even into the start of the production of the movie, nobody was 100% sure if Murray was going to show up. Murray and still does to this day, has a reputation of maybe he'll be there, maybe he won't.
Yeah, he's pretty much aloof. He's Bill Murray. It's pretty much, you sign Bill Murray up, you kind of know what you're getting. It's just the way he is.
Very prickly.
He can be very prickly and very non-reliable, but in the end, the project is gold, usually.
As far as Belushi goes, too, Aykroyd referred to Slimer as Belushi. The whole eating thing in the hallway was based off of the Animal House scene.
Great. Yeah.
They also had considered for the Winston role, which was supposed to be a much bigger role, they had for Eddie Murphy, but Eddie Murphy chose Beverly Hills Cop, which... not a bad choice if you're going on that.
Good choice for Eddie Murphy. I agree.
Especially since that's a starring vehicle, and this would be basically playing the fourth lead in the movie.
Pretty much.
Of course, they went with Ernie Hudson instead. The role for Louis Tully originally was going to go for John Candy. And Candy had already worked with Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, Ivan Reitman on Stripes. And so they were all trying to get him to come aboard, but he didn't understand the character. He wanted to do it in a German accent, and he also then he wanted to have like German shepherds, and they're like, well, they already have enough kind of like dog references in the movie. But John eventually just passed, and they went with Rick Moranis in the role instead.
So they just went with another SCTV star.
Yeah, right. It was SNL and SCTV pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. I mean, this is all Second City and National Lampoon.
Yeah, pretty much.
Originally, Harold Ramis wasn't going to star in this movie, but after writing it, he felt like he was the only guy that can actually play the part. And then Sigourney Weaver, I guess, decided to act like a dog in front of Ivan Reitman in order to get the part, since there would be a part where she turns into a dog. And he's like, well, if you're going to go that route, we might as well just give you the part. And that's basically how the main characters got put onto this.
Iconic.
And then as far as awards go, it was nominated for 2 Academy Awards in 1985, Best Original Song for Ghostbusters by Ray Parker Jr. It lost to Stevie Wonder's I Just Called to Say I Love You.
I hate that song so much. Oh my, that is such a poor representation of Stevie Wonder's music.
Yeah.
I can't believe that Ray Parker Jr., that song was everywhere. Everywhere. You could not escape that song.
The video, especially the video, was just, the music video was
all over
everywhere.
MTV. Mm-hmm. Yeah. MTV probably played it once or twice an hour.
I'm sure. The radio. It was everywhere on the radio.
And it was also nominated for Best Visual Effects, but lost to Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, which that's not, well, you know what? Not as good as a movie, but for special effects, I might have to agree. You know, and we'll talk a little bit more about special effects later on.
What movie did Stevie Wonder win that song for?
He didn't.
The Woman in Red.
Oh, was it Woman in Red with Gene Wilder? Oh,
yeah, that song is in that movie.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Ooh.
Interesting.
Yeah, originally when I saw that, I was like, I didn't know that song was in a movie. And then
I didn't either.
And, yep, surprised Ghostbusters didn't win because the song didn't win for best song because it was... Even to this day, everybody still sings it. Nobody sings "I Just Called to Say I Love You." I just think of Jack Black in Jack Black in High Fidelity. Yeah, guy comes in and tries to buy "I Just Called to Say I Love You," and Jack Black goes, "Is she dying? And, you know, does she have a tumor or something like that?"
So let's talk about the first time we saw this movie. For me, 10 years old when it came out, all I remember is Ghostbusters. Everywhere, you could not get away from it, but for whatever reason I did not see this one in the theater, and I don't know why, but I ended up seeing it the next year on video. I ended up renting it, watching it with the family and stuff, and everyone loved it, but I don't know why I didn't see it in the theater. How about you, Ted?
I would have definitely have rented it too. I would have been a little too young to see it in a movie theater, but it permeated the social landscape through the rest of the 80s. I remember renting it. Yeah, I was a huge Ghostbusters fan. I remember having the lunchbox. I remember watching the TV the cartoons.
Oh, yeah, the cartoon, the marketing. Absolutely. Yeah.
So to pinpoint the exact first time I saw it, I couldn't, probably, but I know I rented it.
85, 86, somewhere around there.
Oh, of course. It's probably around 86, 87. Yeah. So.
I don't remember anyone hating this movie.
Mm-mm. I saw it in theater. I was 12 years old. It was PG.
So it was.
Dad didn't mind dropping me off at the theater to watch it.
Oh, he just left you and said, here you go, Sonny. Enjoy.
My dad is the kind of guy who took me to see Goonies and fell asleep basically about a third of the way through. My dad used to take naps when he used to take us to the movie. He was always exhausted. He worked really hard at the time. Yep, saw it in the theater. All I remember during that time frame was everybody wanting to be a Ghostbuster for Halloween.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody wanted to be a Ghostbuster.
Yes.
Just like Stranger Things.
Yeah, pretty much. That's exactly right. I forgot about that because this came out in June, and it was 7 weeks at number one or something. I mean, it had a run that was incredible for the time. And I think rolling into Halloween, you're right, everyone, you couldn't keep those costumes in stock.
Well, even when I was in early grade school, I remember kids wanting to be Ghostbusters too. For years afterwards, people wanted to be Ghostbusters.
And it's so ironic because you had Ghostbusters 2, and then you had the other semblance of the Ghostbuster movies, which some of them are good and some of them are just complete shit, but it never had the cultural significance that it had for the original, the one in 84. It never was able to even catch a candle to what it had then.
The reason Ghostbusters 2 wasn't nearly as successful with everyone, but it was successful with kids, was because it was geared towards kids. Because Columbia Pictures realized what they had as far as a marketing tool and saw how the kids were attracted to it, and then took out all of the adult humor that made Ghostbusters fun.
I mean, and even the adult humor in the original, even a kid could still laugh at it, maybe not understand it completely.
One part that a kid is probably confused about in 1984. And we'll get to that when we talk about the film.
Yeah.
Were you confused, Ken? Is that what you're saying?
Are you still confused, Ken?
I didn't know what was going on when I was 12, I have to admit. I was a little sheltered at 1984. Some kids were sheltered back then.
We'll definitely explain it to you then.
Yeah, we'll go into strong detail with you.
Use charts, by the way.
Use charts and dolls, absolutely. Yes. Ghosts, we'll use some ghosts. And Mr. Stay Puft, where did Mr. Stay Puft touch you? I get it. Let's talk about part one of Ghostbusters.
Professors Peter Venkman, Ray Stantz, and Egon Spengler experienced their first encounter with the ghost at the New York's public library. The university dean dismisses the credibility of their paranormal-focused research and fires them. The trio responds by establishing Ghostbusters, a paranormal investigation and elimination service operating out of a disused firehouse. They develop high-tech nuclear-powered equipment to capture and contain ghosts, although business is initially slow. Following a paranormal encounter in her apartment, Dana Barrett visits the Ghostbusters. She recounts witnessing a demonic dog-like creature in her refrigerator uttering a single word, Zool. Ray and Egon research Zool and details of Dana's building while Peter inspects her apartment, and unsuccessfully attempts to seduce her. Then the Ghostbusters are hired to remove a blob ghost named Slimer from the Sedgwick Hotel. Having failed to properly test their equipment, Egon warns the group that cross-energy streams of their proton pack weapons could cause a catastrophic explosion. They capture the ghost and deposit in an ecto-containment unit under the firehouse. Supernatural activity rapidly increases across the city, and the Ghostbusters become famous. They hire a fourth member, Winston, to cope with the growing demand. Suspicious of the Ghostbusters, EPA Inspector Walter Peck asks to evaluate their equipment, but Peter rebuffs him. Egon warns that the containment unit is nearing capacity, and supernatural energy is surging across the city. Peter meets with Dana and informs her Zool was a demigod worshipped as a servant to Gozer the Gozerian, a shape-shifting god of destruction. Upon returning home, she is possessed by Zool. A similar entity possesses her neighbor, Lewis. And then Peter arrives and finds the possessed Dana, claiming to be the gatekeeper. Lewis is brought to Egon by the police officers and claims he is Vince Clothro, the keymaster. The Ghostbusters agree they must keep the pair separated. And that's the end of part one of Ghostbusters.
Nice.
Oh, that's almost the whole movie.
It's a good chunk of it. And as you were reading that, I had more great lines that were just coming into my mind.
Oh, there's one right after another. That's the brilliance of this movie. A lot of them are ad-libbed, too.
I love it. He's like, I was born in that house. Right. Everybody has three mortgages today, right?
But 19%.
You didn't even haggle with the guy. Yeah.
You didn't even
just some great stuff. And probably a lot of that was ad-lib, too.
I mean, you have three legitimate comedic geniuses.
Yes.
And Ivan Reitman being a comedic director is really good as well. But, I mean, you have a perfect storm of Second City and National Lampoon right there. I mean, Harold Ramis was instrumental in the National Lampoon. And, of course, Second City with Aykroyd and Bill Murray.
The movie starts out very interesting. You know, the old librarian, you know, encounters the ghost. And then, you know, they come in there and they're like, you know, Egon. You know, they're trying to make themselves out to be really serious and really kind of, you know.
Well, you got really, the two that really are serious, and you have the one that's not. And they use a lot of great practical effects at the beginning of the movie. They have the books that are flying across the bookshelves. And it's on a wire, of course, but I mean,
of course,
you can't see the wire. It's really well done. And then index cards, the library index cards that come out, actually, there was a wall behind there. There was nothing behind the wall. So they just pushed those things out. And then they had air guns that they just would insert there. And then
all the indexes
would just fly right out. Awesome. So just awesome. Easy practical effects.
Quick question. Is Peter Venkman's doing the electroshock test?
Oh, yes.
With the two people. Is the guy that he's doing the test with, is that Horshack from...
No, that's not Horshack, no. But that blonde is like in every 80s movie there is.
No, definitely. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Looks just like him.
I'll tell you what, the effective, it's pissing me off.
$5. $5. Yeah.
You can keep your $5.
Keep your money, yes.
Nobody's asking him to flip over the card when she's right.
Right, exactly, yeah.
If you look at his face when she tries to answer, he kind of scoffs thinking that she's wrong. So maybe he deserves to be shocked.
Pretty but hilarious. Then he's getting one right and he still shocks him, obviously.
Right,
he's,
of course.
Yeah, yes. I'm sorry, it's just not your day.
It's just not your day.
Not your day, yes.
And, you know, it's funny because later on, Vegman says that the kids love them, but on the door,
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't burn in hell.
Burn in hell, yeah.
Yeah. Dean Yeager getting him off campus. Yeah. I assume you're giving us the better quarters. You know, you're being moved off campus, but the kids love us.
I love the library, though. It's so classic. A great way to start it. You know, not jumping right in that they're real Ghostbusters, really. They have an idea, but they're not actually experts. I mean, they don't know how to capture a ghost. Of course, they go, okay, what do we do now?
Right, yeah. Right. Okay, now what?
Yeah, and then
get a ray.
Venkman yeah. first starts go, where are you from? Originally,
yes. Yeah, like,
the best part for me is so they're trying to figure out what to do. So they're huddled up, and then they all kind of peek out around the corner and they look again and then they go back and they keep doing it, and Venkman's like, okay, regroup, let's go back.
Honestly, it's very hard to talk about this movie on a verbal sense because everything in here is really just sight gag. It's so everything visual. You have to really witness the mannerisms of all three of these guys, and just it's really hard to do it the way we're doing it. So hopefully if you're listening to this, you've actually seen this movie appreciate what we're talking about. And if you haven't, it's time to get out from the rock that you've been living under.
It's interesting too when they buy the firehouse. I like to put Lego sets together.
This building should be condemned.
Yeah.
The neighborhood is at the militarized zone.
Right. Yes. I absolutely love the Star Wars Lego sets. In looking for Lego sets, the building is a set.
Is it really? Oh, that's cool.
It's been retired, and I guess it didn't sell well. It is one of the most expensive secondary market Lego sets out there.
Very
I want
cool.
to say the last one I saw for sale was on eBay for like $6,800.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it is not a complex set.
Is that new in the box kind of thing?
Yes. Yeah.
Damn,
yeah.
$6,800 for a Lego?
Yes. Because I guess it didn't sell well. And so they discontinued it.
Wow.
And it's really cool looking. It is the building. But then it has, from the scene where all the ghosts shoot out, you can recreate that at the top of the thing. And yeah, it's a really cool set. There's no way I could sit there and justify that.
I would actually say that the female Ghostbuster movie, even though, you know, we're not reviewing that movie, has probably made that a little bit more popular just because, you know, they were showing iconic stuff in that movie of things that happened in the original movie. The 1984 movie, and of course the firehouse is iconic, and they show you how important that is in that movie, and I wonder if that kind of contributed. They were all excited about the interior set with the pole, not just Aykroyd. Everybody was really psyched about going down the pole that they said, yeah, we have to use this, especially Aykroyd. Aykroyd was like that scene that they basically did there with him saying, we need to stay here tonight. We need to buy this place. That's Aykroyd's initial impression of the set when they first decided to do the set here. He just loved it. They used that, his excitement, and played it out in the movie.
There is a Lego set, too, of the Ecto-1 as well. It's pretty expensive as well. But yeah, I just thought that was kind of cool.
Talking about the Ecto-1, I mean, it's an old ambulance. It looks kind of like a hearse almost, but I guess they only had one.
I thought it was a hearse.
No, it was an ambulance. It was an old school ambulance.
But it had curtains in it, like a hearse.
The siren and everything, I believe, is still the original siren from the ambulance and stuff. Oh, I think the curtains on there were...
For privacy sakes.
I guess they only had one of these. And I guess it actually worked through the whole first movie, but then during the second movie, it actually broke down because it was hard to find another one just like it.
Doesn't Aykroyd own it?
I was listening to the 25th anniversary edition of this movie, and at that time he did not, but it doesn't mean that he doesn't own it now.
I thought one of the three of them did. Well, it wouldn't have been Murray because he doesn't do that sort of thing. I either thought Ramis or Aykroyd owned the original.
If anybody owns it, it would be Aykroyd. Ramis, like I said, Ramis and Reitman were talking about it in the commentary about Aykroyd having it, and Ramis says, no, he doesn't own it yet. He might own it now. It's iconic. Done different things to it now with the sequels. yeah. which I'm not sure if I'm a big fan of, but that's something to talk on another day. Anytime sequels are brought up, Eric's going to go,
Oof. That's a whole other podcast of talking about. You could dedicate just to the sequels alone.
They're rough.
They are rough. Yes, that's a good way to describe it.
Afterlife is okay. I mean, better. I enjoyed it. We'll put it that way because the three of us saw it together in the movie theater. It was okay. It was a good way to spend a couple of hours. The highlight of the movie of Afterlife was the little mini Stay Puft Marshmallow. Because they're
and they're in the new cute. One too, apparently. Because
of course, because they're freaking. Of course, cute.
Why wouldn't they be?
It's a marketing right. thing. Got to have
it's them huge.
Going back to the library part, I want to say one of my favorite parts though is when Murray is interviewing the librarian, and he's asking her questions like, "Any craziness in your family?" You know, my uncle thought he was Saint Jerome, and then
that's
he asks,
a big fat
"So
yes.
that's a yes?
That's a big fat yes.
Are you menstruating right now?"
What does right. that have to do with anything?
I mean, it's just the line of questions.
Yes, yes, I know. It's like, and she's like, what, 80, 90 years old? He's like, yeah. Alice, are you menstruating right now? It's like, what?
It's kind of funny because that actress, you know, she shows up in a lot of movies throughout. The one that I could remember her in was in Awakenings, where I believe she played Robert De Niro's okay. mother. No,
yeah.
No, she was,
no, she was in, mother. She was one of the patients.
She was one of the patients, yes. Yeah. So she's been in a lot of movies.
You like throw a ball at her and she catches it.
She catches it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
You do see though when they get kicked out of the college and then they're talking about catching ghosts and stuff like that. And Venkman is really about, you can see the wheels are turning. He is one of those guys. What is it that basically.
He's a money guy. He's
a con man.
He's like, it can make us what? The what do you say? The. Something rights the
the licensing rights
licensing rights alone will make us rich beyond our wildest. Yeah, he's mm-hmm. he's seeing the big picture when it comes to money.
I wouldn't doubt it. He would be in a Ponzi scheme if he wasn't.
Dean Yeager say? You look at psychiatry as like a dodge or a hustle, and it is kind of true. He does obviously the scene where he's doing the electroshock therapy. He's doing it to pick up the woman, and it's kind of funny too because don't they all look a little old to be in college?
Well, they're professors.
They're professors.
Yeah. Oh, are they? They're really professors?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's still creepy because he looks like he's middle 30s, and she's like probably early 20s.
She's a freshman, man. What are you talking about?
It's creepy still. You know, he's hitting on such a younger.
It happens a lot more than what
I get it.
Honestly, I would not expect anything less from Bill Murray. That's the kind of stuff Bill Murray does. Of course, he's on anything, man. He's hysterical.
He's Bill Murray.
He's Bill Murray. Yeah.
I'm sure he hit on Emma Stone in Zombieland. I mean, come on.
But why wouldn't you?
True that.
True that.
True that. Yeah, man.
Well, I guess we should be talking about the ballroom.
The initial slime. Oh, that's a great scene. Yeah, where he's like, talking about the pricing. He doesn't know what the pricing is.
Yeah.
on capture, and he's like two fingers. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm putting him up against his head.
Yeah. It's great.
They get to
$5,000. I won't pay it. Yes.
Get to the guy's there.
Cockroach like, on 12. Yeah. What are you guys? Some kind of cosmonauts? Yeah.
But it's a real, of course, it's a real
bite
hotel.
Your head off, man.
They actually have used that hotel.
Yes, it is.
In the movie Dave, so Reitman's used it as well in other movies. They use that ballroom as well, but they put a chandelier on top. I think this is the best part of the movie because it sets everything up for everything else at the towards the end. You know, they got the proton pack there in the elevator, and they turn it on.
I love it. They're
like distancing themselves from. Like,
what's
from
wrong?
Ray.
Oh, each one of us is wearing an unlicensed, untested nuclear accelerator on our back. Yeah.
And Aykroyd tells him to flip him on, and then he got right. Venkman. They go back to the edge of the thing after they turn it on.
And of course, as soon as they get out,
I blame myself. I do too. Yes.
They get out, and the first thing that they hear is the maid. And they turn around and she's like, "What the hell are you doing?"
Yeah, yeah. Successful test. Yes.
Sorry.
Yes.
Sorry. Thought you were somebody else. Yeah, and then they like
Slimer. He's like, "What a disgusting blob."
And then they broke up, and he's like, "Yeah, we could do more damage that way."
It's classic. You wonder how many of those are ad libbed.
Don't cross the streams.
Yes.
So, I'm a little fuzzy on the whole bad thing. Yeah.
See, that's a classic line there. Don't cross the streams. I remember hearing that.
Yeah.
So we talk about the special effects here, and I think Slimer is a good special effect. This is
I think he is too.
When they do good special effects.
Except when he's floating around the top of the ceiling in the ballroom and it's just like a green dot.
That's a little bad.
Other than that, in the hallway, it's really actually pretty good.
Yeah. Really well. Mm-hmm. And the guys who they use, because originally they wanted to do industrial light, right? And,
yeah, originally.
But they were committed to Temple of Doom at the time.
Right,
so some guys had jumped ship from industrial light and to form their own company. And I guess... Reitman made a deal with Columbia Pictures.
Yeah, Columbia. Yep.
To front them money to start their own company.
Well, yeah,
some of it works and some of it doesn't. And this is where it works.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about the guys that split off from ILM. These are all the guys who got their start on the original Star Wars. Because ILM is the Lucas farm guys.
If you're comparing this to Star Wars when it comes to special effects, when Star Wars came out, that was a movie that no one ever dreamed of anything like this.
No.
And Ghostbusters is kind of the same way. It's such a unique movie. It's not like rehash kind of stuff. It was such a unique movie when it came out. People are like, whoa, what is this?
This is closer to Poltergeist. Because Poltergeist is made a couple of years earlier.
Poltergeist is 82, but Poltergeist is more believable kind of hauntings and possessions. And, oh my God, this really could happen in my house. And it wasn't a comedy at all. This, really, with the comedic aspects of it, really made it more far-fetched and, okay, Gozer, and they're going to take over all of New York City. I mean, come on. It's really far-fetched. But it was done so well. The writing was so good. The acting was so great. The timing was so great. That's what really made this movie, you know, the movie of 1984.
And make sure you check out our episode on Poltergeist.
Yeah. Check out Poltergeist.
Very good special effects in that movie. And the major guys who were in that film came over to this film.
Well, that's Spielberg. There would have been probably ILM guys involved with Poltergeist too. So
they were ones that made specific monsters and ghosts for the Poltergeist movie. They came
except
over
for the real life corpses that they used.
You want authenticity?
That's something you wouldn't get past today.
Maybe
a bunch of cadavers float around in the pool. Nay.
Yeah. Somehow I don't believe that.
I'll sell my body instead of science to science fiction.
Science fiction. Yeah.
So did so you know way I'm ever going to get into a movie? Here's my old body parts.
So what happened to Dad's body? Well, he donated his body.
Oh, to remember science? That movie we saw last
science
weekend?
Science fiction.
Your dad was there.
He was in it. Number three to the right of the pool. You see the hand pop up. That's Dad.
There's something familiar about that dead body.
Anyway. That suit looks so familiar. What is it?
But the thing is, this movie is such a hybrid of comedy and horror. And it's more comedy.
But not over-the-top horror.
But there are some scary things in this movie for 1984.
Well, when you're 10 years old, I mean, a lot of stuff will just, you know, kind of freak you out. But now you look at it and you're like, oh, yeah.
Well, that's why they caught Magic in a Bottle. Because it wasn't over-the-top scary, it was able to appeal to kids. Kids latched onto it. And they had no idea because it's not over the top freaky.
No, but there's a lot of jump scares here. And going back to the library, when the librarian turns into whatever ape-looking thing that is, it is scary for a 10-year-old to see that. And in fact, it'd be scary for anybody because you don't know what it's going to turn. And that's the scary part. It's not what it turns into. It's the buildup.
But here's the difference. The difference between that is versus a horror movie is you have the librarian transform into the weird whatever, you know, corpse, and then you have the comedic Abbott and Costello timing of those guys like with the music behind it. So it follows like a scary scene with a comedic timing scene, which really I think breaks it up and makes it more palatable, if you will, palatable for like a younger audience.
And mm-hmm. does it 10 times than Abbott and Costello ever.
Well, I just use that because it just kind of reminded me of that.
I disagree with you guys on Abbott and Costello. There's a reason why they were one of the most successful comedy duels of the 30s. Come on.
Yeah, who's on first?
Yeah, what's who's on second? First? We get it. And, I know.
And Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein.
And they meet every monster that's out there. I know.
Ridiculousness.
I get it, man. It just doesn't jive with me. I know they are comedic legends. I know they are like the predecessors of comic. 1930s comedy, vaudeville stuff, it just doesn't jive with me.
Neither. I mean, who's on first is legitimately funny. I get it. And I'll listen to it. But other than that, it's just, I don't.
I mean, it's the classic, I saw something scary, you didn't. But back then, you know, I mean, none of us would find Frankenstein or Dracula scary now, right? But back in 1930, 1940s, that would scare people still.
Well, sure, because special effects are in their infancy, and I get it, yeah. Yeah,
it's more imagination of what could happen, whereas we need special effects to kind of, instead of our imaginations, we want
that. Or we need live corpses floating around in pools.
Right,
this is true.
Yeah. Yeah.
We kind of skipped over, I think, a little bit over is the Dana Barrett character, you know, who...
Oh, a very, very important scene when he meets Dana Barrett. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first, you know, she has the eggs decided to cook.
By the way, did you notice that the marshmallows she buys are Stay Puff?
Of course.
I did not notice it. I did, until this time around watching
it. I know.
It's all product placement.
How did I miss that she bought Stay Puff all these years?
And then Stay Puff is actually on the side of a building as an advertisement.
Sure.
When Stay Puff is walking down the thing, too. So, yeah, Stay Puff is all over. I had never noticed it either. Until watching it recently. Yeah, it's pretty funny.
I thought it was kind of cool, though, seeing those eggs cooked, though. I mean, it's a practical effect. And I guess that counter was really hot, too.
I'm sure it was.
You wanted to stay away from that. And, you know, coming back 2 days later to see, like, eggs all over the place.
And Zool in the fridge. Yeah.
Look at all that junk food. Which one's worse, Zool or all the junk food she had?
She's a single lady.
That my refrigerator doesn't look like that, and I have children living with me at home. That's
unusual for a major appliance.
I like it. She's like, you remind me of a game show host.
I guess that was an ad lib. I thought originally she was supposed to say car salesman, but she decided to go with game show host.
Okay.
Okay.
It's like, yeah, they're kind of stiff.
I like Sigourney Weaver here. She's kind of the perfect straight person for this whole movie. It kind of keeps everything. It brings
until
everything
she
back.
Goes funny.
Well, until she turns into a dog. So she's a dog.
There's the bedroom, but nothing ever happened in there.
What a crime.
Yes, I mean, just great lines.
But yeah, I mean, she sets him up very well. And she's very beautiful. And I love it when he's like trying to prove himself. He's coming out way too strong, of course.
Oh, Hugh. Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But by the time he leaves, you know, he's like, I want to prove myself to her. And it's just about before he's like out the door. He's like, what? No kiss?
No kiss? Yes.
For me, it just cracks me up. I wish I would have seen a little bit more, but they have good chemistry.
They do. Mm-hmm.
I love how she blows off Rick Moranis' character.
Rick
Moranis, he's also very funny. And he's very good in the geeky role.
He does something of a Rule 3. You told me there's a Rule 3. What does he do three times in this movie?
He locks himself out of his own apartment three times.
Yep. And I mean, he's just one of those really smart guys that, you know, he's just hyper.
I love his party. This is Ted and Annette.
He's our accountant, right? Yeah. Hey, this is smoked Nova Scotia salmon, $28.95 a pound.
I got it for this part because it's great.
And he has one hot chick there, and she wants to leave, and he's like, well, if we start dancing, you know, maybe everybody else will start dancing.
Playing Disco Inferno by the Tramps. I love it, yes.
Right, right.
Okay, yeah. But who brought the dog? Yeah.
I mean, it's funny that he could hear. I mean, is he just waiting for Dana to come down the hallway? Because every time she comes down the hallway.
Yes, every time. Yeah, because she's like tiptoeing past his apartment time. He's like, oh, Dana, I thought you were the pharmacist.
I think John Candy would have been fun in this part, too.
Not with a German accent, though.
Not with a German accent.
Yeah.
Oh, Dana. So now I'm thinking Nazis.
But Rick Moranis does play over the top, too.
He's an overtop nerd. He is. It's beautiful. It's perfect. And Rick Moranis. So it's very believable.
Right. So I probably would be okay with not having John Candy here, though. I'm sure John Candy would have done fine here as well.
Oh, I'm sure he would have. I mean, he's John Candy. I can't see anybody but Rick Moranis now. I mean, because he's hilarious. After he turns into the Keymaster, that is some of the most comedic gold. When he's going around the office with Egon and Annie Potts, and he hands him the lamp.
Yeah.
And he drinks the hot water out of the...
Do you want some coffee? Yes, have some. Yes.
And the cop goes, I think that he's for you.
Yeah. Dropping off or picking up? Dropping off.
I think we should get these two together. No, we definitely should not get these two together. Right.
That would be a bad idea.
Bad idea. How about the scene right before he gets possessed where he's locked outside of that restaurant where they won't let him in?
Oh, and all those people are ignoring
big
him.
Glass, yeah, and they're just like, no one sees the big dog going to get him, right?
Well,
they're
even if they don't see the big dog, the fact that he screams and then slides down, like, nobody wants to do
it. His back's up against the glass, yeah, and they're just like...
Bleh. I like when he's in the apartment and he's like, okay, he brought the dog, but that's where... The special effects don't work very well.
No,
they're bad.
Very weak.
Because they're trying to use an optic.
It looks like poor claymation. You're right. It looks really
well. It's got
really
glow. It's got that weird glow to it, and it just doesn't look natural in any type of way.
As he's chasing him down the hall and stuff, it's bad.
If it looks that bad, why even show it? Why just not give us an illusion that something's chasing him?
How does that look on 4K, Ted? Does it look just as bad?
I mean, you can tell. It looks more like claymation than it more like stop motion. What it reminds you of a little bit is the Rankin and Bass stuff.
Oh, that's so great. That's what you want to be compared to.
Yeah.
What it reminds me of is when Superman originally came out on Blu-ray, and they would show him flying up in the sky.
Yeah.
It looked like there was like a green screen behind him. You just could tell.
He was really bad.
It's Christopher Reeve. He could have been, right? Just can't jump over horses.
Can't stay on horses.
Too soon?
Speaking of horses, I love it when Rick Moranis goes up and starts talking to the horse.
Yes.
It makes me laugh every time.
Wait for the sign. Yes.
Right.
Sign we're going out of business.
You're right.
But then you have Sigourney Weaver, who also changes when she becomes possessed. And that's a little freaky when she sits on that chair, and the chair kind of like grabs her in all the different
parts.
It's I think they were violating her a little bit there.
They were violating her a little bit.
It's kind of like the Memorex commercial where the guy's in the chair holding on.
Yeah, and then she's got that great look after the fact, right?
Oh, God, yeah.
Are you the Keymaster?
Then she shuts the door on Vagman. No. She shuts the door on his face.
No. He's looking through the keyhole. He's
like, what? Their whole
interaction. You're the Keymaster. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm a friend of his.
Yes. Do you want this body? Is this a trick question?
Right, yeah. Take me sub creature or something like that. Yeah.
And he's like, no, it seems like there's more than one person there right now.
Sure. No, I can't. No,
there's more than one person.
Yeah, he looks like he got more than one. Yeah, it's just classic.
It's so funny.
It is.
Oh my God.
Rewinding back a little bit.
I know. It's
there's so much to talk about here.
So much to talk about, and it just keeps.
Well, the first section you covered.
In your mind.
The first section you covered was like the majority of the movie.
Well, that's where a good cutoff would be. But there's the part where he does. They finally go back after they become famous, and he does go back to Dana, and she comes out with that other guy, and he's like, "Who's the stiff?"
Oh, yeah.
But then he kind of the
musician.
And then he tells her, "You're the best one in your role." I think that scene, out of all the scenes between him and her, is probably where I buy them as a couple. There's a lot of playfulness. She's reacting perfectly. This is cute now. Whereas like mm-hmm. earlier on, she just wants to get him out of the apartment. We don't see any attraction on her part for him. But the second time around, I think there's just an easiness of it. I think it's because he does have information on her. And he's kind of not as overboard as he once was. I enjoy it. Their chemistry, especially there.
It's cool that they were able to film that outside of the New York Opera House. Yeah, the Met. That's pretty cool.
With a mime.
That's the other thing too. When they're doing the montage of all of the news footage, and the guy's doing the thing on the street, and the one guy comes up behind him and is like picking his nose.
Yeah.
It's just
the Larry King thing? I love Larry King.
Oh, Larry King when he was Larry still on King, the radio. Yeah.
Smoking in the studio. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Larry King.
Everybody wants to know, how's Elvis and have you seen him lately?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, lines like that were kind of stupid, though. And it's like, really?
Yeah, but come on. Elvis died in 77. It's still pretty recent.
This is true.
Yeah. And every supermarket tabloid had Elvis sightings on it.
Right.
Don't you remember World Daily News?
Oh, yeah.
I used to love those when I was a kid, checking out at the, with mom and dad at the grocery store and reading the fake headlines, like 700 pound baby born. It's like, come on, man.
I remember seeing like an article where Elvis's face is in like the door, and then Elvis's middle name, Aaron, is misspelled on his gravesite. Just all these different things on why Elvis is still alive.
Still alive is working for the CIA, faked his own death. Sure.
Right. And just as an aside, I always thought that was cool when they did Men in Black, that they included that was like the real news.
Right. Right. That was their best source of information.
Right. Right.
Yes. The tabloids. Yes.
Right. And of course, we need to talk about Walter Peck. He's, with the EPA.
Oh yeah, when he's kind of baiting him. Yes.
Well, he kind of comes over and he's like, he's trying to be. He's a slime ball.
Use the magic.
Oh yeah, he's like,
please,
Doctor Venkman.
And what are you a doctor of?
What are you a doctor of?
I mean, to a certain extent, he is kind of right to do what he does. I mean, Venkman is kind of a dick to him. And
Oh sure.
He's asking, to look at some stuff. He's from the EPA. I mean, and he's treating him like he's garbage.
He's messing around with him. Sure, he's not taking him seriously. And
I mean, we're going to get the same result regardless if Venkman is polite to him or not. I mean, I'm sure if he met Egon or somebody else, that they would have been a little bit more professionally courteous.
But still, same result. They're not going to let him see any of their proprietary information about how they store ghosts. I love, one of the lines I just remembered when Ernie Hudson is hired, when they're storing the ghosts, he's like, light is green, trap is clean. I use that line all the time.
Where you would use that line?
Whenever I'm talking about like trapping an animal or something.
Oh, okay.
I'll be up, light is green, trap is clean. I don't get out much.
Now that you bring up the Ernie Hudson's character, Winston.
Yeah, we haven't talked about.
What a poor situation for Winston. He's such a fourth wheel. He's not even on the cover of the movie posters.
But
and
think about
it,
though. They hired him out of the paper. I mean, seriously, he answered an ad in the paper walking up to it.
It was not much of an interview process. Hey, this guy wants the job. Oh, you're hired. Here you
they're
go.
Like, oh, do you believe in Loch Ness? And they're, yeah.
All the stuff that they're supposed to believe in.
If there's a paycheck above, I believe anything you...
It's like there's a steady paycheck in?
Yeah.
I'll believe anything you tell me. Yeah.
But it is a really sad, meaningless part. It almost seems like you could even not even have the part.
He is definitely the fourth wheel.
Yeah. And I wanted to know how bigger this would have been. Because some of the lines I'm hearing, I can hear Eddie Murphy saying these lines.
Not clearly. Yeah,
I don't think we'll ever know what it would have been with Eddie.
I guess not.
But just think of that, though. To have those four guys together, Eddie Murphy, Harold Ramis, Dan Aykroyd, and Bill Murray. It definitely could have worked.
It would have been a lot of egos. A lot of egos.
And that's a lot of comedy.
Yes.
The problem I would have with it is Bill Murray and Eddie Murphy. I don't know. They would seem to be too much of the same thing that you're getting.
The smart ass.
Smart asses. that's why Bill Murray works so well here, is he's the guy that basically gets all the smart-ass lines. Ramis and Aykroyd kind of play it more straight, because we haven't really talked much about Aykroyd or Ramis in the situation here, but you have the scene where you have the montage, and then you have the scene where he's having that dream sequence, and he's and he's getting a, well, let's just say it, he's getting a
Hummer.
Hummer from a ghost.
With Ray Parker Jr. in the background there, yeah. Huh?
A succubus. That's the actual technical term for that kind of ghost.
Well, wow.
If you look at the scene, actually, this was going to be a longer scene. This was actually filmed in like some type of castle that Ray went to, him and Winston went to. There was a female ghost, and this actually took place in what had taken place in that scene. The problem was, though, was it was too long of a scene, and it kind of halted the momentum. You might lose your
PG rating, too.
Your PG rating, but it halted the momentum. And so that's why it was put into like the montage towards the end,
It fits perfect right where
it does. It is. It works well.
But as a 12-year-old, I didn't know what was going on.
That's the whole thing, is they kind of leave it open like that.
The adults know what's happening.
The adults get it right.
The kids, it's over their head.
It's perfect. It's the way it should be.
I think we're just on the verge of PG-13 here, and we're not there yet. I think
what was the following year, I think
it's 84 did not have PG-13. I think 85 was the first year. Right. So you probably would have had a PG-13 just with the scary ghosts and stuff. It's literally the fine line between PG and R was just so vague. Yeah, the swearing.
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
The movie that brought PG-13 in was one of the other ones we were talking about earlier, which was Temple of Doom.
The one I remember was, believe it or not, whenever I think of PG-13, is Desperately Seeking Susan. Came out in 86. I remember seeing the trailers, and I'm like, PG-13? What's PG-13?
Didn't mean anything back in the day, because you could still go see it if you were under 13. It was recommended to have a parent.
Unless you had parents that wanted to
drop you off and leave.
Crack down on you and wouldn't let you see PG-13 movies.
I knew a lot of parents that were like that.
Mine were.
Were they?
Mm-hmm.
G, only G for Tettles.
G and PG.
Disney only. Ridiculous. Oh, that explains so much.
My dad was pretty cool. He let me watch Top Gun, so there's that.
Is that PG or PG-13?
PG-13, yeah. Mm. Because of the sex scene.
Oh, it's whatever.
The horrible kissing scene. Oh, I had to go out of the room when I had
little Berlin, take my breath away.
Yeah. Up to that point, I give your dad high praise for bringing you up, but letting you go see Top Gun. I don't know about that.
No, we rented it. It was rented.
Oh, he rented it. Well, that's even worse.
Oh, and he made you leave the room. Hey, Junior, go get me a beer. Make it two.
Cheesiness is the best.
Oh, it's so cheese, but it's still great.
Let's roll into part two with Ken.
Peck returns with law enforcement and city workers to have the Ghostbusters arrested and their containment unit deactivated, causing an explosion that releases the captured ghost. Lewis escapes in the confusion and makes his way to the apartment building to join Dana. In jail, Ray and Egon reveal that Ivo Shandor, leader of the Gozer worshipping cult in the early 20th century, designed Dana's building to function as an antenna to attract and concentrate spiritual energy to summon Gozer and bring about the apocalypse. Faced with supernatural chaos across the city, the Ghostbusters convince the mayor to release them. The Ghostbusters travel to a hidden temple located on the top of the building as Dana and Lewis open the gate between the dimensions and transform into demonic dogs. Gozer appears as a woman and attacks the Ghostbusters, then disappears when they attempt to retaliate. Her disembodied voice demands the Ghostbusters choose the form of their destructor. Ray inadvertently causes a beloved corporate mascot from his childhood, and Gozer reappears as a gigantic Stay Puft Marshmallow Man that begins destroying the city. Against his earlier advice, Egon instructs the team to cross their proton energy streams at the dimensional gate. The resulting explosion destroys Gozer's avatar, banishing it back to its dimension, and closes the gateway. The Ghostbusters rescue Dana and Lewis from the wreckage and are welcome on the streets as heroes. And that's the end of Ghostbusters.
Cool. One of my favorite scenes in this movie is when they're when they're actually in jail and they got all the the plans of the building and they're going over it with
and all of the other inmates, all the
criminals are just like all listening to them. Just the way they're describing everything and the seriousness of Aykroyd's character about this is just it's great.
I guess this they don't make them anymore.
Like yeah, they don't make them like they used to. Evo Shandor did a lot of unnecessary surgeries. Yes, the Tobin Spirit Guide. I mean, just the books they have are just great.
So is that cult leader the same cult leader that we see later on in Ghostbusters Afterlife?
It could be, actually.
Yes, it is. It
is. Yeah. Okay.
For all those kids who haven't seen Afterlife yet, just let's go see it.
Yeah, no, that makes actually a lot of sense.
I guess one of the favorite parts, of course,
those are worshippers. Yes,
I'm going up to convince the mayor.
And
you got the cardinal there. Yeah, and
your eminence. Yes, he kisses the ring. He's like,
Cardinal. Oh,
yeah.
Well, see, right there, that's one of those situations where when Winston talks about being with the company, that's when I see Eddie Murphy being able to do that. That role. Yeah. So
I've seen shit that'll turn you white.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly that was written for Eddie Murphy. Yeah. It just for me, it would sound a little bit more natural coming from Eddie Murphy than
Bernie Hudson. Yeah.
So
that's his iconic line in the movie.
Yeah,
this is like only one of three lines in the movie, I guess.
Three of them. I got to get a lawyer. Yes. If there's a steady paycheck involved, I'll believe anything you tell me. Those are like the three iconics.
So I do like his little one-on-one with Ray when they're talking about the end of times. Yeah, that's a pretty good scene there.
Yes, it is.
Ray doesn't believe in God, but he knows how to quote the Bible. They're talking about end times and how they're thinking, well, maybe this is the end of time. And
the dead are rising from the grave.
Now,
see, that was my quote, the one I had. Ray, when someone asks you if you're a god, you say, yes. There's your Winston Zeddemore quote.
And we were talking about Poltergeist earlier. The thing that reminded me the most of Poltergeist was when the guy gets into the cab after all the ghosts have been released. The cab driver's a corpse. That reminded me the most of Poltergeist or even Night of the Living Dead, or one of those movies.
That is kind of a cool, creepy, yet funny situation. I think that's like perfectly done. And then, of course,
so the ghost comes up through the drain, through the exhaust pipe of the car. Okay. So is the cab, was there someone in there before?
I would say
Or did he just like evolve into a ghost?
I would say it was and that whoever was there is no longer alive.
Oh no, it's a cool effect. That's all I know. It's a realistic looking effect too.
It is.
We're talking about inside the mayor's office. Yes, this guy has no dick.
Dickless over here decided to turn off the containment, sir.
Yes.
It is true. He has no dick.
Now they had other lines for that they still play. Like if you watch Ghostbusters ever on like TBS, TNT, and all that other stuff, which I know Eric
edited
hates,
versions.
They have different lines for that.
Well, they don't say Miller time either. They say it's time for a Coke or something like
that. Do they really? They added out Miller time?
I think
so.
And they also, instead of saying Dickless here, they say, this guy is some type of rodent. This guy is some type of rodent.
Man here, say shut up. Whatever. That's weak. Well, I understand.
I think back in the 80s especially, you realized that you had cable. And
so they would shoot alternate scenes. So it wasn't overdone. They would do alternate takes that this movie was going to go on cable.
Yeah. So that they could show it on NBC or CBS or ABC on
3 years later.
The Sunday night movie. Cause that's how it would progress. It would go movie theater, a home movie, VHS, and then finally on to TV to public TV.
Well, first would be television. Paid cable, and then
HBO, Cinemax, Showtime.
Where I watched like 80% of the movies I ever watched was probably through paid cable, paid movie channels. I didn't like watching Ghostbusters 100 times in a month because they played it every 4 hours.
Yeah, I remember a lot of those movies too. You're right. It's like every 4 hours they would. It's just like the rotation was there. You're like forced to watch it.
Well, yeah, my grandparents had Cinemax. So
when Cinemax,
Lady Chatterley's lover.
That's why I've seen Temple of Doom and Empire Strikes Back more than any other of the other movies in those three series. Because when I would go over to Grandma and Grandpa's house, Temple of Doom and Empire Strikes Back were always on.
Except at 1 o'clock in the morning.
They just put little Teddy in front of the TV and just make them watch it.
No, I wanted to watch it.
He's like, I'm watching Temple of Doom now. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. Leave me alone. What's that tissue next to you? I don't know.
I was little, assholes. But anyway.
Temple of Goo. What's this?
And they would show them back to back. Once Empire was over, it would start over again. Because that's how Cinemax would work.
It's an odd combo, though, those two movies back to back.
It just so happens because they were released so close when they were on Cinemax.
Empire Strikes Back?
It was a few years different.
Empire Strikes Back was 1980.
Right. But when they went on...
Temple of Doom was 84.
By 84, Cinemax had started as an offshoot of HBO.
And they couldn't get Return of the Jedi because it was too new.
Exactly. And it had just probably went from HBO to Cinemax, but they also got the rights to Temple of Doom first. So they were running Temple of Doom all the time, too.
That's why it won the Academy Award.
It's just
for special effects. It was Cinemax.
It was just one of those weird connections that happened to make, and it always sticks out in my mind. I love the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Who doesn't?
The Stay Puft Marshmallow Man is awesome.
He's walking down when we first see him in between buildings. He's got that smile on his face.
That's the part
what did you
so
do,
awesome.
Ray? What did you do?
That's what I love about the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man is he actually
there's something you don't see every day.
He actually has the facial interactions.
Yeah.
It's really cool that way. It's not like just like a Godzilla or something just coming down and just wrecking shop. He can emote a bit. I think it's cool.
There was like some type of Stay Puft Marshmallow guy, but there was also, we also back then had the Pillsbury Doughboy.
A little bit like Pillsbury.
And the Michelin Man.
So and the Michelin Man.
It was kind of like a combination of all those kind of, because the Pillsbury Doughboy had the chef's hat.
Right.
And here you have the sailor hat. So
Michelin Man's made of tires.
he's a sailor. Why don't we just take him down and get laid?
Get him to the dock. Hey, no, he's like, hey, this Mr. Safe Puff's an okay guy. He's a sailor. We get him down to the docks, get him laid, our problems are over.
Yeah. Right.
Great.
Oh God, I love it so much. It's so funny.
Only problem I have with this last kind of scene with the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man is I feel like it's quick. I feel like there's not much of a battle there because most of the battle.
Well, he is made of marshmallow.
They don't even kill him directly. They have to shoot it against the temple.
Sure.
Maybe if he kills Winston or something, make it a little bit more.
Wow. You want to kill
That's
off
dark.
A Ghostbuster?
This is a comedy, man.
Not killing
Holy
him off.
Holy shit.
We already thought that.
Somebody should die. Maybe Peck should die.
Well, we already thought that, Sigourney Weaver and Moranis' characters were dead, right?
No.
You already thought they were converted into dogs.
So, she's a dog.
Then, right. What is it? No, when they're in the prison, what he's talking about, or he's like, I find her interesting because she sleeps above her covers.
Four feet above her covers. Ray has that wonderful line about ceasing all, paranormal activity.
In the New York area, yeah.
Yeah.
County, and City of New York. Way to tell him, Ray.
Ray's very interesting. He's such a technical babble kind of guy. But that's why I think it works having just the three of them. Having the fourth Ghostbuster, really, there's really not much. I mean, later on in Ghostbusters 2, they make him a little bit more of a, I wouldn't say a scaredy cat, but he's the one that gets stuck and almost gets, run over by a train from 200 years ago or whatever the case may be.
I was waiting for someone to play the race card.
It's ironic. My daughter, when she watched this movie with me, she goes, oh, hey, it's the token black guy from every 80s movie.
She's not too far off.
She's very observant.
Yes. I like having Ernie the fourth Hudson. Ghostbuster. Yeah, I mean, whether he's black or white, I like having the fourth Ghostbuster who didn't grow up with these guys, doesn't know these guys, answer an ad in the paper, of course he's not going to be like top tier. They don't know him.
And here again, we don't know exactly. And I don't think we'll ever know, because I don't think that the scripts even exist of what the character was supposed to be. And when it gets stripped down to the bare bones like that, it's really tough. I think Ernie Hudson does a really good job. I actually like his character. And they did expand. You talked about Ghostbusters 2. His character's better in the cartoons.
Right. That's
true.
In the movie here, it's just, I don't know. It doesn't seem to be needed. I mean, what does he do to elevate them? Like, my theory here is
he doesn't need to,
but I think he should though. I think if you bring a fourth character in,
well, the job isn't worth 22.5.
The fourth character, the fourth Ghostbuster, should have done something that made or broke the situation. Like, he saved all three of them, because if it wasn't for that fourth Ghostbuster, then maybe everything wouldn't have worked out.
The formula that you're talking about.
Yeah,
that would have been a better formula for Ghostbusters too,
or any of the other Ghostbusters.
Well, but anyway. If you're based off of Ken's logic, then okay, let's have the original three. Because you're doing a sequel, you want to add a new character, add his character in, and be more consequential in that movie. I can understand that. I'm not going to quibble over how it works.
The movie's still great. Don't get me wrong. I just think that this character, I mean, if you remove this character, it doesn't change anything about this movie. The same movie.
Yeah, that is one of the reasons Ghostbusters 2 fails, is because they try to rehash the old characters instead of introducing new characters. Because Rick Moranis becomes a Ghostbuster.
Well, that's the simplest thing. Yeah,
exactly. They're trying to force old characters into new roles, and that's where it doesn't work, instead of introducing a new character. So I can understand what you're saying there. It's just, I like Ernie Hudson's character. I like Ernie Hudson.
I like Ernie Hudson, and I'm not saying his character is bad. I'm just saying that it's one of those situations where if you remove the character, it doesn't change anything of the story one iota. And I think you should give him a little bit more, something that maybe saved a Ghostbuster, maybe saved Ray, extent.
I understand what you're saying. I really do. And because that is the formula, that if you're writing a movie, that when you introduce a new character, they should have something to do. Especially
he should just die for dying's sake. You know, maybe he sacrifices his life to save others. Becomes his own ghost or something like that. Becomes the good ghost. Maybe we needed a good ghost in this movie, and that could have been Winston. Because really, you don't need Winston in this movie or in the next movie. I would say I like his cameo in Afterlife, and we'll see what they do with him in the new movie. There was an idea of maybe focusing a little bit more on him, because at the end of the last, after Afterlife, they kind of made him kind of like the most successful guy out of the group. You know, he has his own corporation. He kind of still funds Ray's bookstore and things of that nature.
Well, let's talk about the reviews of this movie. Obviously, in 1984, this movie got incredible reviews, as Ted has told us, with Rotten Tomatoes and the people. Everyone loved this movie. My reviewer, I'm going to align myself with Mr. Peter Travers of People Magazine, a fan favorite of ours, says, director Ivan Reitman keeps the Aykroyd-Ramis screenplay zipping right along, creating something like Abbott and Costello meet The Exorcist, which sounds like a pretty good movie in itself there. Aykroyd and Murray make the perfect summer tonic for raising spirits. I can't agree with you more. This movie hit me hard in 1984 when it came out. You couldn't walk down the street without hearing anything or seeing anything related to Ghostbusters. And a 10-year-old Eric was right on board. I jumped on that bandwagon and never got off. Ghostbusters, for me, the original Ghostbusters, gets better and better every time I see this movie. There is nothing about this movie I would change, except maybe the special effects are a little wonky here and there. But you know what? It's 1984. I'll let it slide. This movie is one of my favorite comedies of all time. It's a top 5 pick. For me, this movie is 5 hooks. And if you don't like it, you don't have a sense of humor, in my opinion. Ted, what are your thoughts?
Okay, so I'm going to align myself with Roger Ebert from the Chicago Sun-Times. He stated in his review, in which everybody talks to each other, this movie literally has something for everybody. And I think we've touched on it pretty well. It has stuff for kids, but it also has adults can get in on it. And it's just scary enough that I guess you could... It's a comedy. And you have three of the greatest comedic actors of all time. And a comedy genius writer in Harold Ramis. They're awesome together here. And like I said, it's the perfect marriage of Second City and National Lampoon. It almost is like the coming together for the original Saturday Night Live. It works. And the fact that you have two of the original cast, well, one original cast member, and then Murray came in the second year of Saturday Night Live. But they're just at the top of their game here. It's hilarious. If you've not seen this movie, I don't know, you've been under a rock or something. You have to see it. Hey, this is kind of a stretch here for me, but it's of movies. It's another five hook movie for me too. This is an all timer, and with every sequel that comes out, this one gets better.
Yes, exactly. You appreciate it more and more and more.
It resonates better. The comedy is better. And the writing is better. So with every sequel, it just keeps getting better. But that's, yeah, five hooks. Definitely.
Five hooks. Come on, Ken. Keep us rolling to five hooks. No pressure.
I'm going to go with Richard Schickel of Time Magazine, who wrote, "Whoever thought of having evil's final manifestation take the form of a 100-foot marshmallow man deserves the rational mind's eternal gratitude." Whoever thought of that is kind of amazing. And that would be probably Aykroyd, because Aykroyd had it in his original story, a marshmallow man of that size. This is a great movie. It's funny. It has some scares here and there, but nothing to worry about. But it is a Bill Murray vehicle, let's be honest. Bill Murray makes this thing run, but everybody else is game to be there to support him. There are some problems with the special effects here and there, especially when they have their characters moving around any. I mean, the Marshmallow Man looked fine, but when we got to the doggish looking demon, it just fails, unfortunately. And then there's other parts where you could see that it's a painting. You could just tell that in some aspects of the film, it's just not as good as others. So it's a little uneven, in my opinion, when it comes to special effects. Still good overall, but a little uneven. I'm not going to continue the five hooks. Sorry, guys. But I will give it 4.5 hooks. It is one of the best comedies out there, but I wouldn't necessarily put it in my top 25 movies of all time. But it's probably up there in the top 100 movies of all time somewhere. It's fun. Every time I see it, I enjoy it. What makes this movie stand out from other comedies is the passage of time has not hurt it any. For whatever reason, this movie isn't dated, even though now we have computers everywhere and cell phones everywhere and social media and all that other stuff. And this movie, you could watch it, and for whatever reason, you forget that we have all that type of technology. And the movie can do that, and it's supposed to be a science fiction horror comedy type of movie, it's doing something well. But yes, 4.5 hooks. And on a side note, thank you to Chris Ostrowski, who requested that we do this movie. So this was a fan pick.
Well, Eric, every party has a pooper, and Ken is the pooper.
I don't think 4.5 stars is a pooper, but I'm going to give Ken one final chance to redeem himself on this movie. Ken, can we agree that this is the best Ghostbusters movie out of all of them?
Yes, by far.
Okay, good. By far. So far.
But this is not Blazing Saddles. This is not Airplane. This is not Young Frankenstein for me.
So it's not a Mel Brooks movie, is what you're saying.
Not a Mel Brooks or a Zucker Brothers.
Yeah. That's fine. I'm 4.5. No argument. I just want to make sure you're not aligning yourself with that horrifically bad female Ghostbusters movie.
Oh, no.
Or Ghostbusters 2.
Even though I do like the female Ghostbuster movie, that wouldn't even be even in the four.
I'm still very proud I've never seen it.
Worst movie of the year, clearly.
I'm still very proud I've not seen it.
It's bad.
How can you be really proud of something you've never seen?
I mean, no one says anything good about it.
You were also proud that you didn't see Harry Potter either, but eventually you came around to that.
No, I've never seen a Harry Potter movie yet.
Ted was very proud that he didn't see Harry Potter.
You're comparing the complete and utter misuse of Melissa McCarthy and Kate
McKinnon. Yeah.
You're two female comedic geniuses. You're comparing the complete and utter misuse of those two women to Harry Potter.
No, I'm not comparing it to Harry Potter. I'm comparing it to the fact that you said in the past that you didn't want to see Harry Potter and you were proud of that. The female Ghostbusters is nowhere close to Harry Potter or the first Ghostbuster, but it can rival the second Ghostbuster. It definitely can rival the second
Ghostbusters. Oh, yeah, no, the second Ghostbusters is trash. Still,
in fact, I would put it ahead of the second Ghostbusters. Here's the thing. You say misused, but you don't know they were misused. The performances of that movie are actually good. It's the story and maybe even Chris Hemsworth that might be an issue.
Hemsworth is horrible and their performances are horrible and the plot is horrible.
And that's a misuse there because he's proved as Thor that he's hilarious.
Well, he's probably misused there, but I think he's just trying to be used too calm.
I've seen enough of the trailers that I had no desire to ever see the movie. What I feel like is that is pandering to us to try to get us back into the theater and to see something that was nostalgic. And,
well, that was the last Ghostbusters movie was to get us in the theater.
And it's much better. But that's all that.
How can you guys say it's much better if you? I mean, Eric, I understand because Eric saw it. And so I understand Eric's distaste for it. But you've never seen it, and you're giving a review based on a trailer.
I'm not giving a review. All I said was I'm proud I've never seen it.
You should see it, though. I know it's 2 hours of your life you'll never get back. But just so you can say, dude, this movie is garbage.
And that's another reason. If it's 2 hours.
Is it 2 hours?
The original Ghostbusters, we're talking an hour and a half. And it's concise, to the point, and right there. When you're hitting the 2 hour mark for a comedy, you're really stretching thin sometimes.
I don't know. You know why, Ken, I hate the female Ghostbusters movie so much? Is because I had such high hopes for that movie. It was pandering, and it just bad writing, bad acting. It was just a horrible movie that let me down. No.
People were ripping on that movie before it was even released, before the first trailer came out. Because
I had high hopes for it, though. No. I really wanted. Leslie Jones is not my favorite person, but she's got some good comedic timing possible.
She's funny, too. Yeah.
She is.
Kate McKinnon is really funny in Ghostbusters. In fact, I just think all the female parts are, it's everybody around them that kind of sucks, in my opinion. But anyway, that is a movie that we'll do at another time because I'm sure now one of you will recommend it. That we do it
just to piss Ted off, right? Just to get Ted to watch it, right?
And just to get to see me to watch
it. Yeah. And now we're gonna see have Harry just, Potter just remember come down that the road too.
Ted also hates John Wayne movies, and I guess Abbott and Costello.
John Wayne is a piece of garbage.
John Wayne meets Abbott and Costello.
There's a tragedy of epic proportions.
That would be the Ten Commandments of horrible movies.
Well,
talking about horrible movies, what are we doing next, Ted?
Wow, way to set us up for that one, Ken. I guess this one's going to be a movie of taste here. We're doing the Academy Award-winning movie, Best Movie. I think it walked away with all the awards, didn't it? In 1939. What happened in 1939? Hitler invades Poland. And Gone with the Wind.
And that's
he took power.
He that's
took
not
power
the worst thing that even happened. It's this
I know.
Movie.
So,
and tell
Gone
us
with
why,
the
Ted,
Wind.
We're doing, why we're doing Gone with the Wind. Tell us why.
Why are we, Ted?
My wife won the Oscar
Pick'em
contest. She and Gone with the Wind is one of her favorite movies. So she chose to have us review Gone with the Wind. And we may have a special guest.
She may join us. It's not confirmed yet, but his wife, Michelle, may join us for this.
And it wasn't fixed because this is what I call the most overrated movie of all time. But it is also another importance. This will be our 100th full-length episode. So that's another reason why we're doing Gone with the Wind.
Party! So it's pretty much going to be you and Michelle yelling at each other.
Ken and Michelle, yeah, probably.
Ken and Michelle, yeah.
We are just window dressing.
I told Michelle that I have editing rights, and I'll make her sound like she hates Gone with the Wind. So
it is.
She should use her words very wisely.
When they get together and talk about,
don't say words like racist.
Yeah, don't use any negative words. Everything's positive and cheery.
When they get together and start talking about Gone with the Wind, it can get pretty funny and pretty interesting.
See, that's worth it right there. I just want to be a bystander and listen.
Worth the price of admission.
I'll just say, frankly, Scarred, I don't give a damn every, few minutes.
5 seconds, yeah.
5 seconds. What do you think, Eric? Frankly, Scarlett, I don't,
you really can't
Ted,
quote,
I don't give
you
a damn.
You can't really quote any of the other parts of the movie.
Every 5 minutes, I'll be like asking Michelle, now, how is that not racist?
Just to get her to say the word racist. Say it.
You know you want it.
Oh, great. All right. Tell us where they can find us on the World Wide Web there, Ted.
We can be found on Twitter at @HookedOn_movies. You can interact with us there. There's always a lively discussion going on. And whatever podcast version you're listening to us on, whether it be Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, anywhere that you can, if you can, leave us a 5-star review. Tell us what you think of Ghostbusters. Tell us if you think Gone with the Wind is racist. But just write a nice review. It helps us get noticed. And
maybe not talk about racism. Nice. We probably don't need to do that.
It's the internet. Somebody's going to mention racism.
How about Hitler invading Poland? Yes. Let's talk about
it. How about females doing Ghostbusters anyway?
Yes. Everything. Yes. All right. And then Ken, Facebook, some lively banter there. Some great stuff you've put out.
Yes, thank you for all those who have contributed to the Facebook page. We thank Justin. He does a lot of work on our Facebook page. Always helpful to promote our podcast. And feel free to bring up any movies that you guys want to discuss. Right now, we are kind of filled up with movies for the rest of the year as far as what we're doing. But we're still looking for suggestions down the road. Or you never know when something is more interesting to do than another movie. So yeah, keep it coming.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of Hooked on Movies. I'm going to steal a line from Ghostbusters here because I think it works. It's all over, kids. It's Mila time.
See you at the movies.
See you next time on Hooked on Movies. Who you going to call?
Ghostbusters!